Facing challenges and overcoming setbacks is part of doing business. Whether you have the expertise to survive them or not could mean the difference between success or failure. Welcome to We Are Women, featuring revealing conversations that provide invaluable insights into the success secrets of female masterminds. A must-listen for every entrepreneurial woman. Now here's your host, Janine Vosper.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the We Are Women podcast. My name is Janine Vosper, and with me today I have Karina Esser. Now, Karina is known internationally as the go-to person when it comes to social media marketing. She was raised in Greece, and at the age of 17, she left to London to study television production, and only to have a dream shattered as she discovered the very unstable nature of the industry and the myth of careers. Going to have to ask you some more about that, Karina. She was been made redundant 5 times by the time she reached her mid-20s. And so Karina decided that enough was enough, and she began her journey online, quickly discovering a few powerful strategies that would allow her to leverage the power of social media and the internet. Then Karina started using Twitter to market products. And within 3 weeks, she'd replaced her full-time income working only 2 hours a day. So Karina now owns a social media marketing company, helping businesses around the world leverage the power of social media without doing any of the legwork. Oh, I like the sound of that. Her book, Money on Demand, became a number one international bestseller. Now, she believes that mastering social media marketing is one of the secrets for business to have a leg up in the competition. And Karina's mission is to help 10,000 small business owners attract customers and turn them into brand evangelists by transforming the way they market on social media. Welcome, Karina.
Thanks for having me.
It's very nice to be chatting. We've had a few little glitches in connecting with each other. So I'm very pleased that we are finally having our conversation, and I'm so looking forward to all of the information that you are going to share with us today.
Right, thank you.
Now, there's a few things that were interesting, that particularly in your bio, that must have been a very big deal, leaving your home country and heading to a different country at such a young age of 17. And obviously there was, you know, the language issues. You would have spoken English, but that wasn't your first language though, was it? So how did that feel?
Well, it was very different. Although my father's British and we always spoke English at home, I did have a bit of a culture shock also in the educational system. I when I was living in Greece, I was raised in Greece, and I went to a French school, and then I had, at that stage, I had only experienced the French school system. And then I went to England and I experienced the English system because I studied there. And it's just very, very different. It's a lot more laid back. And we didn't have exams. So I studied at Westminster University, which is a very good university for what I wanted to do, which was TV production. And we didn't have exams. So I studied for 3 years and we didn't have exams, which for me was a shock, because I remember in the French school system, we had an exam for every cough and sneeze, you know. So, and you would get really good grades with very little effort. I mean, probably British people would cringe right now hearing that. But I felt that the British school system was such an easier school system compared to the French one. So I just went through my studies. It just felt like such a breeze. No need to study. You know, whatever assignments I had, I would have really good grades without even trying. So it was 3 very relaxing years, I must say. It's a completely different educational system, where there's no such thing as, you know, there's the professor and the student. You're kind of you're friends with your professor. It's whereas the hierarchy in the French system can really be felt quite strongly.
Well, that is really quite different than anywhere I've heard of, actually. So I'm surprised, because England is such a country with hierarchy and everybody, you know, having set roles. That's very interesting. It's an interesting perspective, because you've got the comparison as well.
Yes, it was like I was always told that the French education system was always a bit harder than the English and the American one. So I knew that. So I came really prepared because everything felt easy when I was studying in England, which was great. I thought it was going to get harder because I was aiming for a bachelor's degree, but it just felt so much easier than my school years for some reason. So it was really, it felt like such a breeze, the 3 years getting my bachelor degree.
I find that really interesting. I'm going to do a little bit of research into that, the comparison between the Australian system as well. But being made redundant 5 times before your mid-20s, how did that feel?
Now, that was hard. Yes, because I was very emotional because it was my dream job. So I studied TV production because my dream job was to become a TV producer. I knew from quite a young age what I wanted to do. So all my other peers, they were struggling to find out what exactly they wanted to do. But I knew exactly what I wanted to do. So I always considered myself lucky because I had no doubt whatsoever that was going to be my career and no one was going to stop me. And so I went and studied that, and then I was told you need to work for free for as long as it takes until you can get a foot in the door. And that's exactly what I did. I worked for free until I got a foot in the door. And then I did some really low paying jobs, which was like slavery, really. I mean, I would work 16 hours a day for below the minimum wage. But I did it because if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. And I always had this sort of attitude. And for quite a few years, I think I worked for about 5 years in the television industry. I felt like I was moving up the corporate ladder, and I became a production assistant, an assistant producer. So I was about maybe 3-4 years. I was about 3-4 years away from being a producer, which was my dream job, And I loved my job. I was really happy. I had no doubts that's what I wanted to do. But unfortunately, it didn't go according to plan. The financial crisis hit. I was working for a Greek TV production company. And as you know, in Greece, they still haven't recovered from the crisis, unfortunately. And we're talking 10 years ago now, and they still haven't recovered. All the companies were downsizing. You couldn't even get a job as a waitress. And so it was really tricky. I was sad as well, and I just felt that I had to work all this time for nothing. That's really how I felt. I felt like I had like a huge loss, like I was grieving.
Yeah, I can imagine. Especially, you know, when you're so focused, it's different when, you know, as you said, some of your contemporaries didn't know what they wanted to do and if they breezed in and out of jobs, but putting that amount of dedication in and then working through. So the skills that you learned from working in the media, that's obviously been really useful though now tying into your social media business as well.
Yes, and I didn't see it at the time, but I was just talking to my husband about it yesterday that although at the time I felt I just wasted my time working all these hours for free to end up doing something completely different, but then when I think about it, I did acquire some skills that have really, really helped me in what I do now, of course, marketing skills, because we used to produce TV commercials. So I got a lot of marketing skills. I got a lot of video skills as well, and presentation skills, just seeing other people talk in front of the camera, because now I have a YouTube channel. So that has helped me a lot. I learned a lot about editing and lighting. Anything that has to do with post-production, I knew, which helps me a lot because obviously the content I produce is in video format. So it has helped me a lot. And also the work ethics. People who work in the media industry, they just somehow work harder, I believe, than in other industries, because you have very small budgets, you have a lot of pressure, and you have really tight deadlines. And there's a huge, you know, huge quality control. So everything needs to be produced fast, but everything needs to be produced on time as well. So it has to be broadcast quality, but also it has to be produced on time. And I think time management skills, just quality control skills, all these skills that I have acquired is thanks to the media industry. So in a way, it's helped me tremendously for what I do now.
Yeah, I can imagine that, because there's quite a few people that, you know, have got into social media, and getting into it 10 years ago would be quite unique too. So having that much experience, just being in that industry for so long, as well as your media experience as well, that would really set you apart. That, and it obviously is why you've done so well in the business as well, is because of everything that you've just mentioned that you can contribute to your business.
Yes, you're right. I was lucky. I got in very early. And at the time, it was very, very niche. So only really cutting edge companies were using social media marketing. It was really, really new. A lot of people at the time when I started used to frown upon it, like, what is Twitter, you know, or Facebook is just for kids, things like that. So a lot of things have changed. And I was very lucky because I got in very early and I got to see all the changes. I got to see how Facebook went from being a social network for kids to now the most popular social network for people over 50. So I've seen that transition as well. I've seen how Twitter was just a very niche social network trying to compete with Facebook. And now Twitter has become a main news platform, the platform that the President of the United States uses now to broadcast news. So I've seen it all. I've seen all the changes. And I still get excited because it changes all the time. So I still get excited because it's never the same.
And probably you're in that industry more than anything else, as you said, changing all of the time. And being on top of that would be a continual learning, nearly on a daily basis, I imagine, Karina.
It does. It changes all the time. Like I can record a video, let's say, on Facebook ads, and then by the time I do the editing, a few days might pass, and then I just realize that what I'm talking about in the video no longer applies because the dashboard has changed, or, you know, instead of saying click on the right-hand side, now the tab is on the left-hand side. It's only 3 days have passed since I recorded the video, so changes happen all the time, and you have to be on top of it all the time if you're going to be in the social media industry.
Wow, yeah. And that's one of the reasons I think that outsourcing is, I mean, a lot of people, you know, obviously do their own, but if you're wanting to do it well, then outsourcing it to a company who's on it all the time makes a lot of sense.
Yes, it doesn't make any sense for people who are not either skilled at it or not passionate about it to do it, because when you don't have the skills or the patience for it, you just end up spinning your wheels. You're wasting your time and you're not doing a good job anyway. I find that a lot of people try and save money by doing social media marketing in-house. So they'll get their receptionist, maybe their admin person to try and do something. But when the person is doing it inconsistently, sporadically, when they can fit it in and they're not skilled, it's not part of a strategic marketing plan that they have, then really it ends up just being a waste of time. You might as well not do it at all. So what I've seen is that companies think they're saving money, but what they're doing is they're wasting time and probably spinning their wheels because nothing is happening. I was at a surgeon's office 2 years ago, and we started chatting about, he asked me what I did for work, and I started telling him about our agency, and I asked him out of curiosity, you know, who does your social media marketing? And we're talking, it's like probably a 7 to 8 figure practice in Sydney, and he's got about 20 members of staff, and he said, oh, it's just the girl at reception who does it when she can fit it in. And I was like, what a shame, because here you have a probably eight figure business with so much staff, and they can't have someone who's who specializes in social media marketing to do their social media marketing for them. And yeah, it's unfortunately the mindset of a lot of companies.
Yeah, absolutely. I know of quite a few companies that, you know, like the size of the one you're talking about or bigger, that, and have got they've actually got products as well, really tangible products, and they just have somebody who can fit it in to do that, the social media marketing. Yeah, which, right, as you said, it's a waste, isn't it?
It is. And social media marketing needs to be taken very seriously. So many people spend so much time and effort designing logos or putting together a website, but I mean, websites are not interactive. Social media is. So that's what you need to, that's what you need to pay attention to. That's where people go to. People don't go to your website, first. They go to your social media profiles first. And for some reason, people just spend so much time, on websites and so much money designing websites, which is really what they are, is like, a nice version of a business card. That's what a website is, and it's not interactive. People can put their feedback, say what they think, etc. Social media is. People can say openly what they think, leave reviews, just interact, engage, and people don't really spend enough time on something that is so interactive. That's where people need to spend time and basically keep a close eye on, because that's where people really express their opinions.
And that makes a lot of sense. And I've never heard that before, that the website's a nice version of a business card. But that's especially if it's not a product-based website, but more of a service-based website. That's definitely what it is. You know, if you're not driving traffic there to buy things, then it really just is a very good-looking business card.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, helping 10,000 small business owners, how are you going with that?
Yeah, we're doing really well. Our book, Money on Demand, became a number one bestseller this year. So we're doing really well. Our YouTube channel has a few thousand subscribers. So, I'm getting a lot of great feedback about the social media marketing courses and just the tutorials that I share online. So, it's looking good. I will not give up until this goal is completed.
Yeah, I like it. I like someone who sets a goal and then go for it. I had one that actually just off that, because we've got to the end of the year, and you know how you reevaluate your goals. I don't know why we tend to do it just mainly at the end and start of a year, but I suppose for most people it's a cutoff point and a new beginning. But I had a level I wanted to reach this year with 3,000 downloads for the podcast, and I've made it over 7.5. So I'm very happy with that. So it's always good to set those goals, isn't it?
That's right. And I make sure I set goals every time. But every time I set a goal and I complete it, I always tell myself, I always underestimate. I should aim higher. I'm very conservative with my goals. So my goal this year is to stop being conservative about my goals.
Oh, that's a good one. I usually say, you know, you need to get, what is it, not comfortable and not delusional, just uncomfortable. So you're pushing yourself out there. Now, yeah. With women in business, I know this is something that's particularly of interest to you as well, is because, you know, we're always having to juggle the work and probably the family life more so than the men do, and to do so without compromising each other and then being able to work from home. So social media would fit into that fairly well, wouldn't it?
Yes, I mean, I'm lucky. Our office, the first floor of where we live is our office. So staff come on the first floor of where we live. So I don't have a big commute. And my husband and I have become foster parents now. And so for the first time this year, we actually had kids at home. And I just realized how hard it is to be a parent, because I never had to worry about managing my time. And everyone used to tell me, how do you balance, you know, work and life? And I'm like, I don't know, I just live. I don't feel like I need to balance anything. I just wake up and live. I don't know what you're talking about, until I started having kids over from the foster system. And then I realized what it was all about, what they meant by how do you balance work and life, because I must say it is very disruptive. Because you see, with children, you probably know that, who am I to tell you, but with children, it's like you're always parenting, you know. It's just they're relentless. They never stop until they get what they want from you. And sometimes it's just attention. So you have to stop everything you're doing, put everything on pause, and just make sure that you're there parenting. And sometimes parenting can just be basically pay attention to what they're saying. And so I've had a huge learning curve this year.
All of the mums out there will know exactly what you're talking about, Corinna. That attention, because your attention is then split, isn't it? And I suppose that's normally what you were saying about the balance, is that you can be focused on work or you can be focused on your socializing or whatever you're doing, which we always talk about, encouraging people to be focused on what you're doing. But when you've got a child interrupting you at the same time, it's hard to keep that attention on one thing.
Yeah, that's right. And I've just realized the importance of having a routine, because a lot of the children that we have, because we're emergency carers, so when there's an emergency or children have just been removed from their biological parents, they'll come to us until the agency finds full-time carers for them. And so usually these children who come to us that never experienced routine, the night might feel like the day for them because they haven't had a set routine of bath time, dinner and sleeping time. And so you have a few days to start creating a routine for them, which they're very responsive to, but you still have to spend a few days until they're in that routine.
Wow.
And it's been very tricky, but we did it and nothing suffered. The kids were great and worked and the companies were still running. So hopefully nothing suffered. At least I didn't see anything suffer from it. But there was a lot of readjusting and prioritizing, really.
Yeah, well done as taking on that role too, because I know the foster system is always looking for carers. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, there's a huge shortage. So especially in our community where we live, there's a huge shortage. So we try our best and we talk about it a lot to people. Hopefully they'll get on board, because there is a huge shortage of foster parents. And unfortunately, the number of foster children who need a home is just growing, because obviously there's more drugs, there's more alcohol, there's more domestic violence, unfortunately. So that number is growing, but the number of foster carers isn't. So we're facing a huge challenge. And unfortunately, what you see in the media is just horror stories of, the horrors of fostering, which is definitely not the truth. It's like 0.01% of what happens. The children we've all had, we've had about 15 different ones come over this year, and they've all been absolutely beautiful children. I would keep all of them. I would adopt them, gladly. They've been beautiful children. They've been a real blessing to us. So hopefully that stigma that foster kids have will eventually disappear.
Yeah.
Because they are children like any other children. They just need to be loved, really. And sometimes they just need a safe environment. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, and that's high on a child's priority of values, is that safety as well. And even as you said, that getting that attention. So then you're working from home as well with the children there. That makes it a bit different. And just back on track with the workings as well. So how can somebody monetize from their social media audience? I know a lot of people with very big audiences, but how do they actually make money out of having a big audience?
Well, with an audience, it all depends on the audience and how the audience was built. So if the audience is very varied and not niche, and they're just people who are fans because you sometimes post funny videos, sometimes it can be an illusion when you have a big audience. You're like, how come you're not making a lot of money if you have such a big audience? And I see that with a lot of celebrities or semi-celebrities, for example, who have large audiences, but they're not niche audiences. They're just big, varied audiences who are just a fan of looking at your face, really, and that's it. So not audiences created equal. They're not all created equal. You can have a small audience, but that's extremely engaged, extremely targeted, and they can be responsive to what you offer. So it all depends on the quality of the audience. So I could have a million followers, but not really be able to monetize much, or you can have an audience of 1,000 people and make a killing. So that's also something that people should know, that not all of you, all audiences are created equal on social media. That's one thing. Another thing with social media is not a platform where people go and buy. They don't have a buying or a shopping mindset. When they go to browse, they go to kill time, connect with people, have a bit of a chit chat, look at what other people are doing. So they don't have a shopping mindset. And so people keep on using social media to push products down their throats, saying, "Hey, buy my stuff, buy my stuff, buy my stuff." But people don't go on social media with a credit card in their pocket. And then they try and force them to buy things, and they're like, "Oh, social media doesn't work. People are not buying from me." You have to remember that what people do is you have to respect the platform if you're trying to monetize it. The platform is there for people to browse and discover things and click on things. It's really what it is. It's clickbait. We call it clickbait because, you know, you're watching one video, the next thing you're watching another video, the next thing, you know, you're reading an article when you're on social media, you're looking at a slideshow. So your main focus when wanting to monetize social media is basically taking people through what I call the slippery slide, where you get them to click on one thing and then click on another and then click on another until you pull them into your funnel. So what I do, and again, that works really well for me, might work for your listeners as well, but it's worked really well for me. Might not work for everyone, I don't know. But what I do is I create YouTube videos. So my videos are a short 5 to 6 minute tutorial on something. So for example, it could be how to build a large audience for your Facebook group, for example. So I'll create a video about that, and I'll post that video on YouTube, but also I'll post it on Facebook and Twitter. People will watch the video. It's all content. They don't need to submit their name and email to anything. They don't have to buy anything. It's just pure content. So I'm slowly, slowly pulling them in my funnel with free content. So I call that clickbait, because I'm telling them, "Hey, here's a free tutorial on how to really nail this strategy." So, and then at the end of my video, what I do is I say, "Oh, by the way, if you like this video, there's another video that I'm going to share with you, and with this other strategy." So I'm pulling them further down my funnel, and I show them a preview of that video. So it's like they're wetting their beak, really. So I show them a preview, and it's on the video, it says this is a preview. So they see the beginning of the video. And then if they want to see the full video, they need to opt in. So at the end of the preview, it says, "Hey, to watch the whole thing, go here and watch the whole thing." And in order to watch the whole thing, they need to put their name and email. And I found that this really pulls them in, because if people have started watching a preview, usually they want to see the end, because it's the juicy part, really. So that really pulls them in my funnel. And then they submit their name and email, and I capture names and email. So I don't ask people to buy anything from me on social media. I just invite them to learn more, because that's what people do on social media. They just discover things. So I'm offering the opportunity for them to discover more stuff. And then that's how I then capture the name and email, and then I run a lot of email marketing campaigns. So make quite a good living out of email marketing campaigns. So that's really, I mean, it's a simplified mm-hmm. version of what I do, but it's worked really, really well. You'll never see me on social media trying to sell anything to anyone. That's why people come to me and say, "How do you monetize? You never sell anything." So it doesn't look mm-hmm. like I am selling, but I'm monetizing.
Yeah, and you're building up
else.
that commitment to you as well. Once people have, they believe in, "Oh, that's really interesting," and that they know that you can offer them value. So it's building up that commitment, and then they're willing to part with their money, as you said, once you get into the email strategy and have the offers that way.
Yes, it helps me in two ways. First of all, it helps me pre-qualify people. So people who are not interested in social media tutorials and all that, well, they won't get much out of subscribing to me. So it pre-qualifies a lot of people. It also allows me to position myself as an expert or as an authority in that industry because I've over-delivered. I've given them a free video, then another preview of another tutorial, etc. And then every 2 or 3 days, I send them other video tutorials for free. So I'm really, not only I'm pre-qualifying them, I'm building trust as well, and I'm building authority. And then eventually they do buy from me. So because we've got different products or services that we offer. So yes, that strategy has worked really well. So in terms of direct monetization, I've personally found that social media is not the best unless you sell physical products, which I don't, unless you sell physical products and things like that. But even so, when you sell physical products, like let's say candles or teeth whitening kits and things like that, you have a lot of competition. So it might not work really well because traffic is quite expensive on social media now. So you might even break even, or sometimes when you sell a product, it can be a loss leader because, you know, it costs you more to acquire that customer than how much you made. But I find that using social media purely for list building is extremely, yeah, extremely
and that's
possible.
You know, that's where the money is in the list, isn't it? So the trends for the coming year, is there anything different or anything that we should know about?
Well, we're definitely going to see more options when it comes to paid advertising, because obviously social media has become like advertising networks. They're putting a lot of money and budget into developing their advertising network. So we're going to see more advanced ways of running ads on Facebook, for example, etc. LinkedIn has ads, Pinterest has ads. So we're going to see more advanced ways to run ads and paid campaigns on social networks. So for advertisers, that's going to be great. Definitely more options for them. We're going to obviously more videos. So videos was really big in 2017. A lot of people are now using videos, like live videos, like Facebook Live, etc. So we're going to see more of that, of course. And also we're going to see more of e-commerce features being built in on social networks. So very soon you'll be able to purchase straight from social networks. So for example, Pinterest has started that, where there's buyable pins and you can buy within Pinterest. So we're going to see more, I think, I mean, I don't know, but I strongly believe, I guess, that we're going to see more e-commerce features being built in on social networks. So now social networks will become more like e-commerce networks, where not only is it going to be a tool where you communicate with people, but it's also where you can complete purchases. You don't have to leave the social network in order to buy something. You can do it straight from the social network. So that's what I think.
And that's been something that they've been trying to do, is to stop people clicking off, isn't it? That's off the network onto another site. But if you're going to be able to buy on the social media platform, then that will make it something totally, totally different then.
Yeah, absolutely. They've been trying with that. And I know, for example, when advertisers were trying to get people to click on links that were outside Facebook would charge you more for these type of ads, where you were asking people to click away from Facebook. So what they did is they enabled you now to create lead capture pages within Facebook, so people didn't have to leave the social network in order to submit their name as an emails for advertisers. So this was really a huge success, because obviously you have built-in lead capture forms now on Facebook. You've got the same on LinkedIn. You can have built-in lead capture forms on LinkedIn as well. You don't have to send people away. And people in general don't like being sent away from the social, from the page they were on initially. So that's great for both parties, for the consumer and the advertiser. And they're going to start doing that with physical products. So Facebook might become a mini eBay or mini Amazon.
That's quite different then as well. And built-in lead capture pages, I've just written it down for LinkedIn. But so is that just something with your basic LinkedIn, or is that something with one of the paid versions?
with LinkedIn ads, the free account, so you don't have to be with premium on LinkedIn, because you know on LinkedIn there's premium and there's a standard account. So just with LinkedIn ads, if you choose a campaign objective lead generation, it allows you to create opt-in forms within LinkedIn, so it captures all the data from the and it's great, it's built in, so you don't have to worry about having external
forms. That's really interesting. That's something that I'll go and check out as well, because I do use LinkedIn a bit. Just talking about that, obviously you have to be over all of the different platforms within social media, but they've all got different purposes, haven't they?
Yeah, so I usually tell people that they don't have to be on every social network. If they're not going to be managed properly, then you might as well just be on one and manage it properly and get results from that one. Because what people do is they get very enthusiastic and they start joining Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest, and then it becomes really difficult and time-consuming to manage them all properly. So I always tell people, just choose your social networks carefully, because there's always going to be new social networks that pop up, etc. So you don't have to be on all of them. Just be on the ones that you can commit to. That's really the key. And the ones where you're most likely to find your target audience. So just to give you an example, for example, Pinterest tends to attract mainly women who are into arts and crafts, or women who are at a particular phase in their life. Usually they're probably about to get married, or they just bought a house. So they are very particular times of their lives they log in onto Pinterest. So if what you offer, if your business offers products or services targeted at these types of women, then Pinterest might be a good option for you. If your target audience is a younger audience, then maybe Instagram would be a better fit, because Instagram tends to attract a younger audience. Facebook tends to attract an older audience. So if your target audience is 50 plus, you'll most probably find that Facebook is great, because you can tap into that audience. If you don't have an advertising budget, I would say, don't bother with Facebook, because it has become a pay-to-play platform. So it really depends on so many things, which social network is the best for people. So just do your research. Don't just join any social network. Be selective and do a good job. So when you select which social network you're going to use to represent your business, then commit to it, because it is time-consuming
properly. Committing to is obviously one of the common mistakes people make. Are there any other mistakes that you see that people are commonly doing out in the world?
Yes, well, doing things sporadically when they can fit it in. That's one thing they do really not that well. Because then you lose the momentum, and also it's not part of a plan, so you don't have a marketing plan, you just do it just to fit it in, and so obviously it doesn't bring you any results, because you're not, you don't have a goal, you don't have KPIs. So obviously when you don't have a goal or KPIs when it comes to marketing, you're really wasting your time. So that's one thing, one mistake that people make. Doing things sporadically, not having a strategic plan also. Again, that goes hand in hand with doing things sporadically. Not having a strategic plan, which means you don't really know what you're using the social networks for or what you're working towards. So that's another mistake people make. Over-promoting, so just trying to turn social networks into a buying platform, which it's not. Instead, just lead them to your funnel, really. Turn them into a lead. The aim really on social media is to get the people who come across whatever you publish to stay as long as possible on your page and consuming your content. So that's the number one priority. It isn't to turn people into buyers necessarily. What you're trying to do is to compete for their time, because there's so many things they could be clicking on. There's dancing dogs and cats and funny babies, and there's so many things they could be clicking on. Really what you're selling is capturing their time so that they spend more time consuming your content. So I think that's what people should be focusing on, aiming at, because people don't go there with
that makes a lot of sense. Intent. Talking about the buying intent, I throughout the year I've been buying things on Instagram most of it. I had all my Christmas shopping done before a couple of months ago because I'd see something I'd go, I'm the worst person when it comes to that. I go, oh, that looks really good. And so I just buy it there and then because it feels like it's going to be good. And I haven't been disappointed once. Everything's been just as they've been shown. But, yeah, I am one of those people that if it looks really cool, actually, I'm talking now about toys for grandchildren. So I suppose that's a completely different market when you're seeing the really bright, shiny objects or the really cute toys come up.
Yeah, for sure. So you've just pre-selected what you were going to buy just based on Instagram?
Most of them were on Instagram, yeah.
Yeah, that just goes to show it's just social media is such a powerful platform to just prepare people to buy. So, it just builds brand awareness and it nurtures people and they become front of mind. So when you keep on seeing them in your feed, then next time when you're ready to buy, that's the people that you remember to buy it from. So it's so great for building brand awareness and also for preparing people to buy and for them to be front of mind, for companies to be front of mind.
It certainly worked for me, worked on me, I mean. but it also meant because I prefer to shop that way than go into stores. So it that particularly worked for me as well. Now, building a large audience is one thing, but how do you get them engaged as well? And we've been talking a lot about it, but I know I see some people that, especially, you know, they may have only had four posts and they've got, 10,000 followers. There's obviously something that they're doing to develop that.
There's different ways to build engagement. The first thing is you have to have an engaged audience. So how you've built the audience is going to really shape how much engagement you get. So if the audience is not targeted, you might you won't have a lot of luck in terms of engagement. Or if the audience is not an engaged audience in general, so for example, if there are people who don't necessarily engage back, that's also a no-no because you can have a big audience, but they'll never be engaged. So what people do is, on Twitter, for example, they'll follow a bunch of people for a percentage of them to follow them back. And that's how they build their audience. So they follow a bunch of people without putting any thought into who they're following. And then these people follow back, probably 10%, usually out of courtesy or usually automatically. Whoever follows them, they follow back automatically. But that doesn't guarantee that these people are going to engage with your content. So when you build the audience, that's really very important because it's going to shape how much engagement you get. So I tell people, well, if you're going to build that audience that way where, you follow people so that a percentage of them follow you back. In that case, when you follow people, be selective of who you follow. Don't follow, for example, the Financial Times because they might follow you back, but they'll never engage with your content. So, and that's a big generalization, but you just paint a picture. But instead, why don't you go and look at your competitors or your indirect competitors, if people don't have direct competitors, and follow the people who actually leave comments on specific posts, who like specific posts, because you know that if they engage with content, or your competitors' content, they're most likely to engage with yours. And so that's how you can pre-select an audience. That's how you can pre-select who's going to follow you and make sure that they engage, because there's a huge majority of people who, are on social media to look at other people's stuff, but they don't engage. I'm like that. I look at other people's stuff, but I don't really engage. But there's another big chunk of people who engage a lot. And so these are the ones that you need to focus on if you want to build engagement. So that's one way. Another way is by having engaging content. So don't just publish posts like use it as a PR service. You're using social media as a PR service. Hey, we've just released a new product. Here it is. And expect people to engage with it. Because it's not, again, it's not a a press release. You don't use social media to broadcast your press release. Have engaging content where people are going to actually contribute to whatever you've published, share their opinion, share their concerns, their views. So have engaging mm-hmm. content in the first place as well. Don't think, you know, here's my new book, buy it now, and expect people to, you know, to engage. That's not the type of content people engage with. So that's another way. And also not being afraid of using tools that help a little bit with engagement, like hashtags, including hashtags and tagging people when it's appropriate. So you don't want to just use hashtags and tagging people just for the sake of doing it. But when you can fit it in, when it makes sense, do it, because that helps a lot. Tagging and hashtagging helps a lot. And then if you still need a bit of a boost because maybe your post didn't get enough eyeballs, or because your post didn't get enough eyeballs, you didn't get enough engagement, you can always boost the post with paid advertising. So many ways.
Yeah, and there is. And that's part of the benefit of using someone like your services, because you know what's worked, you know what hasn't worked, and you've got the experience there to support that knowledge. So instead of wasting money, and I know I've spoken to a couple of people just recently who have said, oh, I've just done this ad and it's cost me $60 or whatever. It's not too bad to see how it goes. But I know that they have just randomly done it. They haven't got any training or knowledge about what they're doing. So I hope it works for them, and I'll be really interested in the results. But it's different when you're working with it all the time and you know what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, you absolutely have to have a strategy when it comes to social media marketing. Have a strategy, because what happens when you decide to promote something, no matter what, Facebook or Twitter or whatever social network you're using, they would chew your budget. So they will spend mm-hmm. that budget no matter what, right? They don't care. They're getting paid, you know. So it's very easy to fall into the trap of like just hemorrhaging money through ads, because no matter what, they will spend your money. And if it's not part of a strategy, if you don't have an end goal in mind, if you don't know your numbers, it's so easy to just waste money. I've done it. I know it. Like, I've just poured a bunch of money on a campaign, not really knowing what to expect from it, but I had the budget. Let's spend it and see what happens, and fingers crossed. And I've done all these mistakes. I've probably done it more than anyone else, really. It makes no sense whatsoever, because, you know, they're going to spend your money anyway. And you don't really know what you did it for, what the end goal was for. And that's why I always tell people, before you do anything, have a strategy. Make sure that whatever you plan to spend money on is part of your strategy and is going to help you move closer to completing your goal. And also know your numbers. So know what you can afford to have, cost per click, cost per lead, all that is very important. So, you know, some people, they lose money if their cost per lead is more than $20. So, you know, why would you go on Facebook and spend $30 per lead if you know that, you know, the company's going to be losing money if you acquire leads for over $20. So knowing your numbers also is key. People don't know how much traffic is worth to them, you know, how much a click is worth to them, how much a lead is worth to them. People don't know their numbers, and then they go and spend money on advertising. And it's just it's mind-boggling, really, because
I've seen
money.
It happen all the time. Now, I know you've given us a ton of content, a ton of information, but if we're going to take away three main points, what would they be, Karina?
Well, I think the first thing is being picky with a social network mm-hmm. that you're going to be choosing. Don't want too many social networks if you can't commit to all of them and doing a good job on all of them, because it is a huge time commitment. So don't be... Don't just fall in the trap of thinking, I'm just going to have an automated software that's going to handle all this, because there's no such thing. So be picky about the social network. That's definitely number one. Number two is have a strategic plan. Don't touch social networks if it's not part of an overall social media, an overall marketing campaign, really. So have a strategic plan. And I think number three would definitely be know your numbers before you get into it. So know how much you can afford to invest, know how much you can afford to lose, because obviously with any campaign, some campaigns just smash it, some don't, and that's just the reality for everyone.
As you said, some, that's very important. I don't know a lot of people that actually do that unless they're doing what you're doing and focused on social media marketing. But I remember I was listening to one speaker and they ran the same ad with a pink background and a blue background. And what ended up happening is they would normally get about 70% men in their audience, but because they ran it with a pink background as well, they had 70% women in that audience and filled that audience a lot quicker than what they had done in the past. And they ran exactly the same ad, but just with a different color background. So knowing how to make the most of your marketing dollars by doing something like that, because they had the funds to trial it, but it obviously worked, is so vital, isn't it?
That's so interesting, and it just reminds me of split testing and the importance of split testing. And sometimes you test a bunch of things, and it's never what you think is going to work that actually works. I remember we were running a campaign for Harry Dent. I don't know if you're familiar with Harry Dent, but in a nutshell, he's quite a well-known economist, as he's a New York Times best-selling author. And we were running campaigns for him here in Australia, and we just didn't have enough visuals. He wasn't providing us with enough visuals to run his ads, and obviously ads need to have visuals. And so we were really stuck in terms of visuals. We didn't have enough pictures or variations of him, and enough pictures of him. And so he had sent us a really small picture of him, and it was too small to turn into an ad. So what we did is, we ran out of ideas of what to do with the very little we had. So we decided to duplicate his image. So it's his image twice next to each other and turn it as an ad, so as the image for the ad. So there was two pictures of him, almost like we made a mistake. We doubled up. Mm-hmm. It looked like a mistake, really. It looked like we just doubled up by putting two pictures of the same thing on that ad. And we just ran with it because it was getting late and we're just tired and we had run out of ideas, and we just ran that one. And that's the one that just outperformed all the other ads for some reason. So it's never, ever what you think. Sometimes I'm a bit reluctant to do something because I'm like, it's not going to work. And then I do it anyway because I've run out of other ideas, and it's the one that works
amazing,
the
isn't it?
Best.
Yeah, so, and as you said, the split testing is the vital part of that, isn't it? Because it can be one thing that can just look different, like that one was blue or pink, and it just changed the whole dynamics of the people that responded. And it was really interesting, that particular ad. I had about five people send it to me because of the way that it was worded. They thought it would be something that was of interest to me. So yeah, so there were other people were passing it on. It was well done, actually. Yeah, very, very impressed. Look, Karina, that's an incredible amount of information. I am sure the listeners are going to go, wow, and they've been taking a ton of notes. I guarantee it, because there's just so much there to learn from you on the topic of social media. And so to do that, to learn more, obviously looking at your, not just looking, but subscribing to your YouTube channel?
Yeah, sure. So it's youtube.com/social media worldwide. And there I've got over 100 video tutorials on social media marketing. So whether you're into Pinterest or Facebook or Twitter or Google Plus or LinkedIn, you'll find what you're looking for. So tons of tutorials there on the YouTube channel. I've also got a Facebook page. So facebook.com/SMW. So SMW stands for Social Media Worldwide. So SMW Online. That's our Facebook page, or you can just type in Social Media Worldwide in the search engine of Facebook. You'll find our Facebook page there. And we've got our website as well, socialmediaworldwide.com. Yeah, it just describes all the services, etc., how you can get in touch, our contact details.
Yeah, that's great. So there's lots of ways that people can find you. And I'm sure that a lot of the listeners are going to be subscribing to that YouTube channel, because that just makes a lot of sense to be able to listen to an expert, and especially if there's something that you're not sure on. And because you can you could be wasting a lot of time and money, and but it just, you know, 5 minute educational might just clarify something for somebody.
Yeah, for sure. Like the risk that people run when they don't know what they're doing is they can really lose their shirt by doing social media, running social media campaigns, because it can get really expensive if you don't know what you're doing. So you have to get smart, you have to get educated and learn.
Absolutely. Look, thank you, Karina. I'm glad that we got over our little glitches from earlier and we actually were able to have the conversation. So if anyone wants to get in touch with Karina Esser, it is your social media worldwide. You'd find her everywhere by putting in that, I would imagine. So thank you very much, Karina. I have really enjoyed our conversation. I've got a ton out of it myself, and I look forward to going on and subscribing to your YouTube channel.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And that's another episode of the We Are Women podcast. I'm Janine Vosby, your host, and I look forward to you joining me next time. Bye for now.
So, do you feel stuck in a rut in business? Visit speechperfect.com.au and download Janine's free ebook to avoid the 5 most common stumbling blocks women face in business. It's jam-packed full of tips to overcome the barriers that could be holding you back from the success that you dream your business will be. We would love you to leave a review of today's episode and share this podcast with other women in need of entrepreneurial inspiration. Subscribe to the next episode now and join the We Are Women community.